Welcome to a brand new episode of Kind to Your Mind. This time I'm joined by a former professional rugby league player who has reached the very top of his game, but has also personally experienced rock bottom, and now uses that experience to help others. Danny Sculthorpe, welcome along.
Great to be here, thanks for having me.
You played close to 250 games, the highest level of rugby league in Super League, part of a sporting family. Can you give us some background as to how you got started?
Okay, yeah. I've got two older brothers in Paul and Lee. We were young kids, we had a lot of energy. To be honest, me and Paul really never got on as kids. Now we're best mates and we never really got on. And my mum and dad, when I was six and Paul was eight, decided that enough was enough. And they said, right, you need to go and play rugby because you've got too much aggression. You're taking it out on each other. Why don't you go down to rugby and take your aggression out on other people instead of each other? So that's exactly what we did. Took us down to a team in Oldham called Royton Tigers. We went down there and after our first session, we absolutely loved it. Knocking people about and not getting done for it. It was absolutely fantastic. So we stuck at it, and we ended up both making a decent career. Paul's more than mine, but we both made a career out of playing professional rugby league. Anyhow, going back to when we were kids, I had five games left. And when I came back off that tour, the coach said to me, Danny, I know you've just signed a contract at Leeds Rhinos, which I did as a kid when I came back from that tour. I'd signed for Leeds and the coach at Water had said to me, you've got five amateur games left. You can. I'm going to play your sub. I don't want you getting injured for your professional career. I'm going to play your sub and I'll put you on if needed. Anyhow, we ended up playing Eccles, a team from Salford. When I took that ball in for the first time, I got the ball and drove into the defensive line. I dislocated my kneecap. But unfortunately for me, that injury brought on type 1 diabetes and I become an insulin-dependent diabetic because of the shock of that injury. Now, when I went over to Leeds, I had no other type 1 diabetic really to look up to. So I just thought I'd do what I thought was best and eat a lot of carbohydrates. And I was embarrassed to go hypo, where your blood sugars drop in front of people. I didn't want to go hypo before, during and after training, in front of my teammates or in front of my new family. So I started eating a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of pasta, a lot of rice, a lot of bread and stuff like that. And unfortunately for me, I've gone from being about 15 and a half stone as a 16-year-old kid to nearly 19 stone within about 6-7 months. Leeds at the time, because I put so much weight on, they got me road running. So I ended up getting shin splints, which put me out of training further, which meant I put more weight on. And then within 12 months, I got released from my contract at Leeds. And I ended up moving over to Warrington Wolves as part of the Yestin Harris deal. Leeds ended up paying Warrington £350,000 plus me. So really, I was the first £1 million player.
Wow.
So I ended up moving from Leeds to Warrington, went back home with my mum and dad. Tried getting my diet sorted out. Unfortunately, though, for 12 months, I still struggled with my weight, still struggled with my diet, and I ended up getting released from Warrington. And I thought that was it. My career is over. There's no way I can be a type 1 diabetic and be an elite sportsman. I thought that's it. All the effort that I've put in as a kid has been stopped by that single injury at Eccles. I thought, that's it, mate. It's done. There's no chance I can play again. Absolutely flogged myself. Got my diet right at home. Worked hard in the sheet metal shop. I did about a four-month pre-season. So I ended up going to Rochdale. And the season started and I was still an academy player. And then after two or three games, they decided to put me in the reserve team. Within about 2 months, I was playing on a Thursday in the reserves. I was playing Saturday in the academy and I was playing Sunday in the first team. So I was playing three games every single week, professional level, quite a high level. And I got myself really, really, really fit until within 6 months, I was just playing first team rugby. I ended up playing about 80 consecutive games for Rochdale over the next 2.5 years. Then in 2001, all my dreams came true and I got an invite to go and speak to Maurice Lindsay at Wigan and go and sign for them. And that's when, my rugby league career really took off in Super League. So I'd gone from being a big fish in the Championship, where I got voted Player of the Year twice, to being a little fish in a massive pond, playing with such as Chris Radlinski, Adrian Lamb, Terry Newton, Terry O'Connor, Quentin Ponga, Craig Smith, Dave Ferner, Brett Dallas, and the best of them all was Andrew Farrell. And a lot of Australians who came over playing for Wigan couldn't really handle Fazzy's, the pressure he put on people. And I thought, well, if you're such an unbelievable player and such a well-respected guy, there must be the reason why. So what I used to do, I used to really emulate him and try and follow him and taking his example on. So I remember when we used to train at 9 a.m. in the morning doing our weights, a lot of players would turn up at 5 to 9, 10 to 9, but Faz had been in there from 7 a.m. He'd have done a six-mile run, he'd have done all his stretching, all his prehab, all his TheraBand stretching and stuff like that before any of them were turning up. So I thought, this is the way you need to do it. So I ended up playing for Wigan for 5 years, which was absolutely fantastic. You know, I absolutely loved my time under Stuart Raper and Mike Gregory. I was lucky enough during that time in 2004 to play for Lancashire versus Yorkshire at Oddsall Stadium. I was lucky enough to play in the 2004 Challenge Cup final at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff in front of 80,000 people in a Wigan versus St Helens derby. Now, don't know you guys, whether you're football or rugby, but what I know is that in rugby league, the biggest derby in probably in the world is Wigan versus St Helens. The towns are connected. Yeah. Both towns hate each other. The fans hate each other. The clubs hate each other. It was absolutely awesome.
And the thing there, of course, is that you've got the family link, because your brother was the captain of your biggest rivals.
What made it even more special that day was I was playing for Wigan and Paul was captain of St Helens, and we were the first two brothers that could do this, that had done this, should I say. So you can imagine my mum and dad, first two people ever to be sat there a minute to three knowing they were going to win. How good was it for them? Absolutely unbelievable.
But what a journey, though, to go from your parents, you know, saying, look, you need to stop knocking 10 bells out of each other, you know, in the garden or whatever, to then sort of be doing it at the Millennium Stadium and places like that.
Absolutely. You know, my mum and dad used to go out on a Sunday night when we were kids. They used to go down to the Oldham Cricket Club, and they used to come back and the house would be smashed up, and that's the reason why they wanted us to go and play rugby. And now they're going watching us in front of 80,000 people at Millennium Stadium in the biggest rugby league game in the season, wanting us to belt each other and giving it our all. For 3 hours, we hated each other, which it weren't that hard, to be honest. Like I said, we never got on as kids, but we grew to really, really love each other. And it was just an amazing pride for me, just knowing that my mum and dad were there just watching us and just being proud of us both. We were lucky enough to play in some absolutely massive games, Good Friday games, and I was also lucky that during my Wigan time that I represented England 8 times. I captained England 2 times on a tour of South Africa. This has gone from a lad who's been knocked back from 2 Super League clubs, been released because of me illness as being a type 1 diabetic, putting loads of weight on, and now I'm going over to South Africa as captain of an England team with such as Rob Burrow, Danny Maguire, Chris Thorne and Martin Gleeson, Rob Purden, players like that. It was just an unbelievable achievement for me, and my son's got my shirt up in his room. It was fantastic, and it was a time where there was a great Britain team such as our kid, Andy Farrell, Adrian Morley, Terry Newton, Kevin Sinfield, players like that. And then there was an England team, the young kids coming through, such as myself and Rob Burrow, Danny Maguire, and the players I've just mentioned. So for me, it was an unbelievable 5 years at Wigan, and I absolutely loved it. But unfortunately, a coach came in called Ian Millward, who had coached St Helens, and he'd had a bit of a fallout with our kid and decided to take it out on me, and he released me from my contract in my last year at Wigan. He phoned me up from Manchester Airport as he was about to get on a plane to Australia, and he said, right, Danny, you're not wanted at Wigan, you need to go and find another club. This was 2 weeks before my wedding, so it was it had a massive impact on me. But not only did it have a massive impact on me, it also left me really, really angry that he couldn't even come face to face and speak to me. He had to do it over a phone call, and he hadn't given me a chance to reply. I remember he just putting the phone down. He said to me, you need to find another club, find it as quick as you can. I'm going back to Australia. When I come back, I want you gone. And he was playing players that following year, players who couldn't lace my boots. And that's not me being big-headed. That's just me being confident that I was miles better player than the players he was playing. It was just something real personal why he did it. I remember the Wigan fans kicking off and putting stuff on social media. This is a disgrace and stuff. But I thought, well, it is what it is. I'm gonna move. I remember speaking to my agent, a guy called Andy Clark, and he rang me up a couple of days later. He said, Danny, I've got your move to Castleford Tigers. And I thought, oh, I'm a Wigan player. I've gone from being at the JJB Stadium, DW Stadium, now we're under the best facilities, the best training ground, the best field, to going down to Weldon Road at Castleford and playing with them. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to enjoy this. Anyhow, Castleford gave me my same deal that I was on at Wigan. And believe me, I absolutely loved my time at Cass. You know, and if we'd have stayed up that year, I'd have stayed there. I'd have stayed there forever. I love the town. I love the people. I love the club and I love the coach, Terry Matteson, at the time. We had a good crack. He was a real man, good man management. Unfortunately, that year in 2006 in Super League, it was the first time there was promotion and relegation. Now, the team that finished bottom should have been relegated, but that was a new team from France called the Catalan Dragons, and they had a three-year exemption from relegation. So we finished second to the bottom, so we got sent down instead. But I had a really good year that year, probably my best year personally as a player, and I ended up moving to Wakefield, another club in Super League. And I ended up moving and I signed a four-year deal at Bradford Bulls, and that's when things took a turn for the worst.
So from what you've described there in great detail, how your career built up, you've overcome challenges, obviously your diabetes, obviously maybe thinking at one point you weren't going to make it, but then actually making it to the very top of what is a really tough sport, and not just physically on the pitch, but the people that you're surrounded by are really quite tough characters as well, quite blunt, as you've pointed out there with the coach there giving you that sort of news in a very sort of harsh format. I mean, these must have been very tricky things for you to deal with, mentally. And what are the mental challenges that you face in sport? Because you have the highs. You've had that being at that club that you loved at Wigan and achieving the great heights, getting to the Challenge Cup final. Wigan, a formidable team in that league. As you said, that you were one of the key players, and then getting dropped like that. I mean, how do things like that affect you as a person when you leave the stadium or the training ground and you go home? You have to take that with you, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And you take it home. You don't realise. I didn't understand mental health back in 2006. I really didn't. But when you come to think about it now, I understand mental health. It will have had a big impact on me. You see, rugby players and professional sportsmen, they probably have, in a year, they probably have about 50 highs, which the average person in the world probably has 10 in a year. So you go from 50 to zero. That's when players really struggle after retirement, because they've gone from walking out in front of 50, 60,000 people, everyone chanting the name, everyone wanting to speak to them, everyone, wanting their autographs, to being just an average person in the streets. And that's why a lot of players really do struggle. And me living in Wigan when I was playing for them and then being asked to leave, it probably did have a massive impact on me, but I didn't really realise it because I didn't understand it. I'd probably just come home and think I was in a bad mood because I've had a bad day. But really, it's probably a lot of things building up in my head, and a lot of things were snowballing inside. The move to Cass ended up being a good one. And we as people, as men, we're always really good at thinking about the negatives. We always think, if I got a 9 out of 10 game, I'd always think about the one, why didn't I get that 10 out of 10? Why did I miss that one tackle? I might have made 40, but if I miss one, I'd always think of that one. If I dropped a ball, I'd never think about the 25 that I've caught. I'd always think about the one that I dropped. And that's what people are like in everyday life. We always think about the negatives, and that's the reason why we've got to try and turn things around. You look at what's going on now, there's a lot of negatives that you can pull from it, but there's also a lot of positives. A lot of people might be working from home. They'll be seeing a lot more of the kids than they normally would do. Things can turn and change with this COVID stuff, but you've just got to try and think about the positives that we can take from it. And there is a lot when you really think about it and sit down and really concentrate on mental health and how big impact it can have. There's a lot of positives that we can take from it.
On the subject of your mental health in particular, you alluded just before that when you were playing for the Bradford Bulls, that's when things started to take a turn for the worse. And your mental health there eventually took you to some particularly dark places. I mean, talk about what happened and what you experienced during that time.
Yeah, certainly will. So I signed for Bradford in October 2010, but my wife was in hospital with gallstones, so I had to start pre-season a little bit late because I was home with my two young children, Ellie and Louis. So I started on the 1st of November, and everything, as soon as I started, loved the club. I've always loved Oddsall Stadium. I've loved playing at Oddsall. I couldn't wait to get playing there. Steve McNamara was there and everything was going okay. And I'd started pre-season, like I said, on the 1st of November. I'd probably done about 3 weeks. I was working really hard, getting really, really fit. But then it was a Monday morning, it was about the 20th of November, something like that. And I remember it was a Monday morning. We'd had a flogging on the field, been absolutely smashed on the field, loads of contact, loads of running, absolutely knackered. We'd had our dinner, and then in the afternoon we started a legs weight session, which is horrible anyway. So we were doing the weights in the gym. I'd done a few different exercises in the gym, and then I went over to the squat rack to do some squatting, which is a bar on the back of your neck. You do a squat, and you're working on all the power, so your leg speed's quicker and you're more powerful to get bust through them tackles. So I was doing some squatting. I did a squat with about 100K on my neck and I prolapsed the disc in the bottom of my spine. I went in for surgery. I had the disc shaved. 2 weeks later, I had the disc shaved. It released the sciatic nerve. I woke up in recovery and all the pain had gone. All I could think to myself was, yes, I'm going to be back playing with my 25, 30 best mates before I know it. And they used to class them as my best mates because I probably spent more time with them than I did with my wife and kids, to be fair. The day after the operation, the surgeon came to see me on the ward. He said, Danny, everything went great with your surgery. Everything I did was spot on. No complications at all. You can go home today. So I'd had major back surgery. I was home within 24 hours. Things couldn't get any better. I thought, I'm on the road to recovery. A nice one. Unfortunately for me, I'd been at home about 2 weeks and I started getting these absolutely unbelievable, unbearable pains that I cannot even explain how bad they were. And I've got a high pain threshold. And these pains were pains that I could not cope with. I waited for the results. The results came back to show that I'd picked up two massive, massive MRSA infections in the bottom of my spine. I'd picked up an infection called osteomyelitis, which is a bone-eating infection. But I'd also caught sepsis as well, which is an infection that kills people. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it didn't kill me, but what it did do, it put me straight back into hospital. I didn't even have a chance to go home to see my kids and my wife. I went straight from his office, straight onto a ward, and I was there for 3 months. So I was drinking Oromorph, liquid morphine, like it was pop. I was on OxyContin and OxyNorm, a slow-acting and quick-acting morphine. They put me on 100 microgram fentanyl patches, which is the closest thing to heroin, and I was having shots of ketamine every 4 hours. All strong opiate drugs that people get addicted to. And I did get addicted to them because I ended up being on these drugs for nearly 9 months. And the withdrawal and the weaning off and the coming off all them drugs was just as bad as the actual injury. After I'd been in hospital a week, they fitted a tube in my chest called a Hickman line, which used to hang down at the front of my chest, and it went through my chest and it connected to my heart. And what they used to do was hook it up to a drip. So the antibiotics would go through the drip, through the tube, to my heart. Then my heart could flash it around my body. Then it'd get to my spine quicker than if they did it through a cannula in my hand. After being in hospital a month, they decided to do another MRI scan to compare it with the one that I'd had previously. And when they got the results back from that MRI scan, it was showing more and more damage to the bottom of my spine. The surgeon was at the side. I remember being groggy and out of it up a little bit with all the drugs that they'd gave me when they'd knocked me out. But I remember waking up and I remember just looking at him with my fingers crossed. And I remember just saying to him, Doc, what have you done? Please give me some good news, mate. I've just signed a new contract at a new club. And I'm a professional rugby league player who's just hitting his peak as a 30-year-old prop forward. I'm hitting my peak. I'm playing my best rugby. I said, but forget all that. I said, I've got two young kids and a wife at home who's been a full-time mum. Everything that I bring home is for my family. I said, please give me some good news. I need this. I need to play rugby to support my family. He turned around to me, he said, Danny, unfortunately, mate, I can't give you any good news. He said, the damage this infection has done was so big. I've had to remove the full disc at the L3-4 level, but I've also had to take the bottom part of your spine away. I've had to fuse your back with metal cages, rods and screws. When I came out of hospital, for the next 6 months, I was having nurses coming to my house 3 times a day to give me the drugs, the antibiotics, the painkillers. But I remember thinking to myself, I've gone from being this professional sportsman training 3-4 times a day to being able to just about do this. I used to get out of my bed in the morning, and with all the effort that I had in my body, I would use it all up just about to get from my bed and just about get on my couch. At night, I used to get off my couch and just about make it to my bed. I couldn't even get to the toilet. I couldn't go to rugby with Louis. I couldn't go dancing with Ellie. All the things that I used to take for granted, I couldn't do again. And then I got a phone call off Bradford. Instead of them paying me medical bills, putting me through physio, making sure I had some sort of quality of life, even if I couldn't play rugby again, Bradford did none of that. What Bradford decided to do was rip up my contract, which meant I lost my job, I lost my career, and we lost our family house when I had 2 young kids and a wife that I couldn't support. And that's when I started suffering from depression really bad. And I'll be brutally honest with you now, and anybody who listens to this, if you can take anything from this, I couldn't get the thought of suicide out of my mind. Every minute of every hour of every day was how I was going to kill myself. Should I get in my car? Should I wrap it round a tree? Should I take loads of pills and drink loads of ale? And it wasn't that I didn't love my family. I love my wife. I love my mum and dad. I love my brothers. I love my kids more than anything. It's just that I felt like I was a burden to them. I felt like if I'm not here, someone would give my kids a better way of life. Someone would bring them up better than me. Someone would give my wife a better life. I just thought everyone would be better off without me. So I started doing the typical bloke thing. I started putting these daft masks on, hiding everything, pretending I was okay when really I was dying inside. And I remember keeping these thoughts to myself for about 3 months until I found myself in the middle of Wigan in my car in a car park. No idea how I'd got there. And I remember being sat there facing the trees in this car park. In the side of me in the passenger seat was a bottle of gin and a box full of pills that had killed half of Wigan. And I remember sitting there thinking, I'm going to do it. But something stopped me. And I don't know what it was that stopped me, because if I try and go back there now and think about what I was thinking then, I can't get there. It's impossible for me to get there. I'm probably happier now than I've ever been, even when I was playing for my country. And if I try and go back to that dark place and try and think about what I was going through then, I can't get there, which is a really good sign. I don't know whether it was my kids, my wife, my parents came to me, or I just bottled it. I don't know, but something stopped me. I remember going home from the car park, being really cheesed off. I had a plan, and now I didn't know what I was going to do. I got back on the couch, I put the drink and the drugs away, and I carried on doing what I'd been doing for months, ignoring my wife, snapping at my kids, not talking to my parents, ignoring my brothers. But the biggest thing that I did, I started to talk just that little bit, just that tiny bit. I started talking to my friends just that little bit. They noticed a massive difference in the way I was acting, the way I was talking. And I remember a week later, they must have spoke to my mum and dad and my wife. I remember a week later, my mum, my dad, my wife walked into the front room with a dining room chair. They turned the telly off in front of me. And I remember snapping at them saying, what are you doing? And they turned the telly off. They sat in front of me and they said, right, you are going to tell us what's going on in your head. You've completely changed. You've gone from being this most loving family man, where your family means everything to you, to hating everything and everyone. So I thought, right, I'm going to tell you then. If you're asking the question, I'm going to tell you. So I told them about the suicidal thoughts. I told them I was suffering from depression. I felt like I'd let them all down. I would lost everything because of me. But me just getting that off my chest for the first time was an unbelievable feeling. It felt like a massive weight had gone there and then. It was unbelievable, honestly. So we spent hours talking and crying. And me as a rugby player, I was a prop forward who used to like dishing it out. You know, I love cracking people. I love the rough stuff. But I'm a really, really, really emotional guy. I cried all the way through my wedding speech. I cry all the way through DIY SOS on a Wednesday night. But that doesn't that doesn't make me any softer as a man. No. That just shows that I'm an emotional guy. So what? So we spent hours talking and crying and talking, decided to go and see my GP. My GP put me on some antidepressant medication, mirtazapine and citalopram. But the biggest thing that saved my life more than anything was talking. And that suits me down to the ground because I'm from Oldham and I'm tight and talking doesn't cost anything. I got talking to a counsellor from a clinic called Sporting Chance, which was set up by Tony Adams, the ex-England and Arsenal captain. And I used to see my counsellor twice a week for a month. Then it went to once a week, to once a fortnight, to once a month, to once every 3 months. And now we just talk as friends on the phone. So if I can leave anyone with two messages that I try and leave everyone, if they're feeling like things are getting on top of them, whether it's the home life, the social life, the work life, whether it's COVID, whether it's anxiety, stress, depression, please, 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 please speak to someone about it. Because I know for a fact, if I didn't speak to my mum and dad and my wife that day, 100% now, I know I would not be here. I'd have ruined my kids' life. I'd have ruined my parents' life, my wife's life. And I know for a fact my youngest daughter wouldn't have even been born. And I cannot imagine this world without our Isla. Mm. But the most important point I always try and leave people with is that you don't have to be on a rugby field, a football field, netball court to be part of a team. Every single person around you, whether it's a family member, a friend, a work colleague, a guy at the pub, the gym, the hairdresser's a part of your team. And if you notice a difference in their personality, the guy who's gone from taking the mick all the time to not doing, the guy who's gone from being this laid-back, social guy who's always having a laugh and a joke to not doing, just ask him if he's okay. But please don't take the stock answer is yes, I'm fine, as an answer. If you've seen that difference in him, tell him you've seen that difference in him. You might give them that bit of courage then to open up, tell you a few of their issues, and you never know, that simple question then might just save a life.
Well, we're pleased that you changed your mind on that day and you are still with us, because it is an incredible story. I think that will certainly make a lot of people think, you know, even people who are not suffering or maybe listening to this who have never suffered from any form of mental health, it's important to recognise the signs as well, isn't it? I mean, you were saying there, really, it was your family who spoke to you. I mean, what questions can men particularly, because men, I think, you know, as you have alluded to, have a very sort of a macho kind of image perhaps sometimes and hide behind that mask. I mean, what questions can people ask those that maybe are, you know, not themselves or seem to have a lower mood or there's been a difference in their personality, and how can you bring the conversation out?
I don't think anybody has to be a clinician to do it. I think all you have to do is just have that open conversation. If you see that difference, and just tell them you've seen a difference in them. Tell them they've gone from, like I said before, having the crack to not doing. They've gone from, you're always taking the mick out of me. You normally come for a pint after work on a Friday. You've stopped doing that. Just give them that. Just give them that bit of courage to open up. And you don't have to be a clinician to do that. All you have to do is give them that opportunity to open up. And like it did with me that first time I opened up, that probably was the time that saved my life. And like I said, you don't have to be a clinician. You know, 13 men every day take their own life in the UK, and I know that's going higher and higher and higher. And that's a full rugby league team every single day in the UK. You know, on a construction site, you're 5 times more likely to die by suicide than you are from an accident on site. Again, a massive stat. But I'll tell you a stat that really scares men, is that 78% of all diagnoses with mental health issues in doctors' surgeries are female, but 78% of all suicides are men. That is a scary stat, and that I'll use an analogy with you now. If I'm at a rugby match or a football match and I go into the toilets at halftime and it's packed out, I know for a fact what I'll do. I'll walk up to the stones, I'll stand there, I'll be having a wee, and I won't look left, I won't look right, and I definitely don't look down. I'll do what I have to do and I'll get out as quick as I can. But that's how men treat mental health. They won't look to the left for help. They won't look to the right for help. They'll try and deal with it themselves, and that's when tragedies happen. Now, if we speak to the women about going to the toilet, for them it's like a team sport. There's 3 and 4 at a time. They talk to each other. They'll get things off the chest. And that's how women treat mental health, and that's why the suicide stats are like they are, because women are more inclined to talk to someone. They're more inclined to speak about this weakness, so-called weakness.
Since you finished playing, you're now involved in the charity State of Mind, which is aimed at those in rugby league, but also in sport in general, but people beyond that too, to help get the conversation going and to help people out who maybe are finding themselves in a similar situation to perhaps you found yourself in all those years ago.
Yeah, 100%. I'll give you a bit of background on State of Mind. So State of Mind was formed after the tragic death of not only a teammate of mine, but also my best friend, in Terry Newton. Terry had played for Wigan, Leeds, Bradford, played for Great Britain 23 times. At the age of 30, he signed a two-year deal at Wakefield. He'd had a brilliant pre-season, looking really fit, really sharp. You know, he was on point. Halfway through that year, he picked up an injury. Now, Terry off the field was very easily led, and he got talked into taking something called human growth hormone, which is a banned substance in our game. And Terry was actually the first person in any sport in the world to get tested positive for growth, and he got a two-year ban from the sport, which ended his career. Now, me personally, I don't believe that Terry missed playing. I think the two things that he lost more than anything was being around his mates every day, being that professional sportsman as a job, having the crack, that changing room banter. But the thing that he lost more than anything was his identity. He was no longer Terry Newton, that rugby league player. He was just Terry Newton. He couldn't come to terms with it. When his ban kicked in after 3 months, he went on Sky Sports doing an interview with Brian Carney on a programme called Super League Supermen. And you can watch it back now on YouTube. And I watch it all the time. And I'm looking through. Now I understand mental health and working mental health. I can see Terry all the way through that programme asking for help without him actually saying, I need help. He was saying things, I've let my teammates down. I've let the sport down. I've let the fans down. You know, I've let the town down. I've let everyone down, but most importantly, I've let my wife and my two kids down. That to me is Terry waving that flag, playing, see, please someone come and help me. But back in 2010, no one recognised it because of the stigma. I know for a fact that it's not depression, anxiety, stress, low mood, what's killing people and killing men. What is killing us is stigma. Stigma is the killer because men think they can't come forward and seek help. So Terry didn't. He didn't come forward. 6 months later, he took his own life and his family home. Sent massive shockwaves around the sport. Two guys wrote letters into the local rugby league paper, Malcolm Ray and Ernie Bembo. And Dr. Phil Cooper from the North West Boroughs Health Care read these two letters and decided to form a meeting between the three. And that's when State of Mind was formed and they become our three co-founders. And for the last 9-10 years... we've spoke to over 100,000 people, whether it be in sports clubs, rugby teams, football teams, rugby union clubs, whether it be in prisons, police, fire service, whether it be in construction, colleges, schools. We've spoke to over 100,000 people, and over the last 9 years, we've been told at least 150 times that we've changed someone's mind on taking their own life just by a presentation that we deliver. And I'll give you an example of this. We did a construction site in London for a Costain. And I remember this guy, when we were telling my story and doing the presentation, I remember him, probably about 20 stone, big lad, massive beard. He got up and he was in floods of tears and he walked out. Anyhow, at the end of the presentation, I found him and I had about an hour's chat with him. And he says, I'm living in a house in London. I'm originally from Hull. I'm living in London with five other guys who smoke weed all the time. He says, I'm sat there, I go in, I do 12-hour shift, I'll pick a takeaway up, I'll lock myself in my bedroom and I'll get up for work the next day. I says, but I'm sick of the way I am. I have 12 days on, I have 2 days off. He says, I drive home after 12 days back to Hull, and every time I drive back to Hull, I park up on Humber Bridge every single time and I contemplate jumping off. So I had a chat with him. I went seeing his manager with him. They ended up getting him a new house. He changed all his routine, his lifestyle around. He's eating more healthier. And I went back about 3 months later to do session two for Costain. And he came over to me. He said, Danny, I'm in a different house. I'm in with three other different lads who are like me. They're more conscious about the health and stuff. And even my wife and my kids come down here to see me. And they've never, ever done that before. He says, thanks to your talk, you've probably saved my life. And that is just one of many, many people who have told us that because of a session that we deliver. we change people's minds on taking their own life. Now, for me, if I can save one life over my lifetime doing mental health, I've done my job. But for it to be so many in such a short time, and it was a massive tragedy that Terry died through suicide, but because of his legacy now and through state of mind, he doesn't realise how many lives he's now actually saving. And they are just examples of people who have told us. Some people have probably, we've probably had a big impact on them, but they've never told us as well.
So at least 150 that you think you've have certainly changed their mind over over potentially taking their life and seeking help. I mean, that's a phenomenal change, really, isn't it? And you must be very proud of how that's helped people.
Oh yeah, massively proud. I am prouder for the work I've done in mental health more than my rugby league career, and probably it's more rewarding. It's a lot more rewarding. I absolutely, and I'm not just saying this, but I absolutely love my work in mental health. I really do. I see some sad things, and I read up on sad things, and I look at sad things, but I know that we're having a massive impact on people. And if you're saving lives, you're not only saving their life, but you're saving their kids' life. You know, they're more susceptible. If someone takes their own life, if they've got kids, then the kids are more susceptible to take their own life. And it's just like a vicious circle. And, you know, we're having a big impact. And, you know, what other thing can you think of that is better for my mental health than going out and actually saving lives every day as a job?
Well, Danny, it's been fascinating and inspiring hearing your story today, and not only how you turned your own situation around, but how you've turned around the situation of so many other people, and people that you don't even, you know personally, or probably, you know, only know anecdotally. You know, it's such a massive difference, and it all comes down to talking. I mean, before we go, just the final points to take away, really, for people who are hearing this from the point of view of perhaps they know somebody whose personality has perhaps changed over something. I mean, obviously, we're in the time of recording this on the cusp of another lockdown, and I think it's maybe going to hit people a little bit harder this time than maybe first from the mental point of view, because of how 2020 has treated people. Jobs are changing, maybe people are losing jobs, and their lifestyles are changing. And from the point of view of somebody who's hearing this and maybe is resonating with what you've said of how they are feeling and how they should take that step to get some help.
Yeah, it's for me, you know, if you are struggling, please, please, please talk to someone. There's lots of people out there. There's a lot of clinicians out there. There's a lot of friends out there that you can speak to. Don't keep anything bottled up. You know, it is a strength. It's not a weakness to be able to speak about your issues. Don't be using the bad coping strategies, drinking drugs. You know, drinking drugs to numb feelings is just totally wrong. You know, drinking drugs are a depressant, but a lot of people, and a lot of men in particular, use drinking drugs as a coping mechanism to try and numb them feelings. But when you wake up the next day, you've spent a fortune, you're rough, and that problem's still there. Try and use talking. And if you're speaking to someone who's struggling, don't be scared of using the word suicide. If you think they are in a bad place, ask them if they're feeling suicidal. You're never, ever going to put that thought in their head. They might tell you that they are thinking about it. You're not going to put that in their head. You're not going to make people do it. And everyone's scared of using the word suicide when you're having that conversation, but you shouldn't be. But what you might do, you might give them that bit of courage to say, yes, I am feeling suicidal. And that's when you can get help and support, and it can be sought. Use exercise. Exercise is my biggest antidepressant now, along with talking. Now you're in lockdown, use exercise. Go walking down over the fields. Go walking around the park. Go walking down the canal. I take my dog out. If I'm feeling like I'm having a bit of a bad day, I will take my dog out for a 6-7 mile walk. I come back and I feel miles better. Just be able to and feel comfortable that one in four people suffer from a mental health issue, whether it be anxiety, stress, depression, low mood. One in four people. So if there's 100 people listen to this program, or I don't know how many people will listen to this, but just for an example, if there's 100 people listen to this, 25 people will be struggling. But I can guarantee that every single one of them 25 that are struggling will think that they're on their own. when that is far from the truth. It really is. Let's just look out for each other, but most of all, look out for yourself. If you look after yourself and look after your own mental health, then you can look after others even better.
Thanks so much, Danny. It's been inspiring, and I'm sure people listening to this will take on board what you've said and maybe save another life too.
Thank you.
Thank you to Danny Sculthorpe there for joining us on Kind to Your Mind. We always love hearing from you, so please leave us a comment and don't forget to hit subscribe and rate the podcast. This series is in conjunction with your local councils and the NHS in Cheshire and Merseyside. For more information, visit kindtoyourmind.org, where you'll find lots of information and resources, including top tips from the Every Mind Matters campaign and ALMA, an online wellbeing portal for those living and working in Cheshire and Merseyside. Until next time on Kind to Your Mind, stay safe and goodbye.